We'll call this meeting of the Crime Victims Criminal Records Subcommittee to order. First order of business would be the approval of minutes from the previous meeting. Representative Caff, would you like to move the minutes?
Move the minutes from our last meeting. Mr. Chairman?
Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Minutes are passed. First bill for consideration is House File Number 3130. Chair Lesh, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you. Yes, I would move, Mr. Chair, that House File 3130 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Crime Victim. What's our committee referring it to? Public Safety Policy, Mr. Chair. That committee, that's where I want it to go.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lesh. We have House File 3130 before us. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, House File 3130 can be much better explained by the individuals who it impacts most directly, that being the chiefs and firefighters in the individual departments. So I'll let Mr. Strike and Mr. Winkle speak to that.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Jerry Strike, representing the Minnesota Fire Chief Association. This bill has been brought forward after some frustration, if you will, in gathering post-employment criminal history data, meaning the employee has already been part of our group or as an employee for some time. The statutes, through my research, generally pertain to candidates or new hires, and we would like to add a provision or amend our statute to allow us to conduct a post-employment criminal history check once a year for employees that have been hired. In my current role as a fire chief, back in August of 2008, I took the realm of fire chief in the metro area. It was like going to China for me because I knew no one there, and I've never been there before. Unfortunately, I didn't know the people that were working for me either. I did get wind of an employee that I had that had some criminal history, and I was concerned that that individual was not meeting or was not fitting the core values or mission of the district in which I serve. I tried to collect that data, and I was unable to because the data requires consent of the individual. Make a long story short, and I know this is an extreme case, but after several months of working on the issue, this employee ended up murdering his wife and then killing himself. I know that this would not have certainly halted that incident from occurring, but what it would have done, it would have allowed me, in the interest of public safety, to look at this individual and see if that's the type of individual I want responding to Mrs. Citizen with the sore arm, or Mr. Citizen who's calling us to respond to protect their property and life. So as I gathered the information and looked through the laws and spoke with individuals, I felt that this is something that needs to move forward to give the fire chief, who's responsible for the individual and the employees that are serving the community. So.
Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Lesh?
Mr. Chair, we do have another testifier who'd like to speak to this too.
Okay. Please come to the table and identify yourselves for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Dan Winkle, the fire chief of the City of Andover and also president of the Minnesota State Fire Department Association. I'm here today just in support of this. Our organization definitely would be in favor of telling our members, you know, you have to maintain a certain level of professionalism as you respond as firefighters. Our group does represent about 15,000 firefighters out of the 20 in the state. So we're definitely in support of this bill. And we do hear of instances every once in a while, believe it or not, but we can have a bad apple out there in the fire service. Who maybe isn't behaving or, as Chief Strike mentioned, living up to the standards, and it would be nice to be able to have capabilities to do background checks to make sure that they are doing what they should be doing.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesch, I just want to make sure I'm reading the bill correctly, especially Subdivision 5. It seems to me that we're requiring, we would be requiring fire departments to come up with a process, a procedure for doing employee checks, and that those checks couldn't happen more than once a year. But we're not mandating any kind of timeline, correct, other than to say you can't do it every 6 months. You can't do it more frequently than once a year. So if the city of Victoria, which has a volunteer fire department, decides, you know what, we want to do it every 3 years, and Waconia says we want to do it every 2, and Norwood Young America says we want to do it every 5, that would be permissible. You're just requiring some kind of procedure and that it happen no more frequently than once a year. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, that's correct. That's the way I think it would work in those fire departments. I know, for example, in my city, St. Paul, some of the bigger cities, they're represented by bargaining units, and I suspect that some of this may be negotiated as well. But, yeah, for the most part, you're correct in your assessment of that, Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesch, I'm fine with this. You know, every time we do this, though, of course, there's a cost associated, whether there's a hard dollar cost or there's time, administrative time, in doing this. So there are costs associated with it. I'm fine with it. I don't have a problem with it. But I just, you know, we got to be cognizant of that. I mean, I understand the fire service is here asking for this, and I'm willing to. I don't have any problem with it. But you know, there's a cost associated with it, hard dollar cost, and then the time on both ends, on the fire service's end, in requesting and reviewing the reports, and somebody's got to compile the information and send it in. So this isn't without cost, and I just think we need to be cognizant of that as we move it forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from the committee? All right, if I may ask a question of the testifiers or Representative Lesch, when these background checks are done, will the records be stored within the fire department, or will they be destroyed as soon as they're reviewed and determined not to be of any further value?
Mr. Chair, the information would be considered private data, and it would be handled as any private data would be in our fire district or fire department. So we would be destroying that. The information is at times held in a personnel file, which is secured.
All right. Thank you.
Then, Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 3130 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight.
Thank you, Representative Lesch. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
All my bills now, or just the gang strike?
We're actually going to do Representative Hillstrom, Representative Paymar. Sorry, I should have clarified that.
I've got a testifier who has to leave.
Oh, you have, okay. Representative Hillstrom, is that right if we do Representative Paymar? Okay, then Representative Paymar moves House File 2965 that it be recommended to. Moves House File 2965 that it be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the House Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. Representative Paymar, you do have a delete all amendment, I believe.
Mr. Chair, the DE4 should be the DE4 amendment that I would like to move.
Then Chair moves that the DE4 amendment Thank you. Okay, that chair moves that DE4 amendment be moved to be put in the bill be put in the shape that the author would like.
Chair, I also have a couple of oral amendments. You want me to take those now and get it all done? Just, there's a couple of typos here. That
let's do that all together then, Mr. Representative Paymar.
Okay, then on line 2.28, strike the word oversight and insert the word coordinating. And on line 5.31, on where it says section 299, insert A. Is that it? Is that it, Ms. Pierce? Okay. Then that's the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Paymar. One moment. Representative Paymar moves to incorporate the stated oral amendments into the DE4 amendment, the first being on line 2.28, the word oversight be stricken and the word coordinating be inserted, and then on line 5.31, after the 9, the letter A be inserted before the period. Is that the amendment as requested?
That is the amendment.
Then Representative Paymar moves that those changes be incorporated. All in favor of those changes to the DE4 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed say no. Motion passes. So we do have the DE4 amendment as amended before us. Representative Paymar, would you please state the content of the DE4 amendment?
Mr. Chair, with your permission, what I would like to do is to just make some opening comments and have Mr. Nobles from the Legislative Auditor speak briefly. He has a prior commitment, and then I would walk you through the bill, if I could, and explain each section, if that would be okay.
Go ahead and proceed with that, Representative Paymar.
Members, I don't think we need to rehash everything that's happened as the scandal with the Metro Gang Strike Force came to light this past year. We've had several hearings, and most of you have been present for those hearings over the summer. I think for all of us, this has been a difficult time, and I think it's been a difficult time for law enforcement. And I believe that the behavior of some of the officers in the Metro Gang Strike Force, in my estimation, in my work with law enforcement, does not reflect the professionalism of most law enforcement in this state, nor is the behavior of the advisory board for the Metro Gang Strike Force a reflection on the other gang and drug strike forces in Minnesota. However, I think it's clear that the misconduct by officers in the Metro Gang Strike Force and the failure of proper oversight must not happen again. So what this bill tries to do, Mr. Chair, members, is, and I think it does, addresses the findings and the recommendations in both the OLA report as well as the Lugar report that was conducted on behalf of the Department of Safety. So I know Mr. Nobles has a prior commitment, so I'd just like him to give a brief overview of what transpired during his audit and investigation of the strike force.
Thank you, Representative Paymar. Mr. Nobles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for accommodating my schedule. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the Legislative Auditor. And as Representative Paymar said, I think all of you at the table are very familiar with the events that occurred in our report. So let me just be very brief. And I think that Representative Holberg really summed it up when she first heard the results of our investigation. And she said that what we found at the Metro Gang Strike Force was scary, very scary. And I think what she was referring to and what concerned us all was that we found a police organization that was not only being poorly managed, but that was without adequate oversight, accountability, and control. Now, when you find a situation like that, you do have to look at the causes. And clearly, there were certain police officers that were responsible for much of the activity. And I think that the commander, the former commander, bears some responsibility as well. But I think that what was even greater concern in some ways is the lack of the oversight structure to recognize and mitigate and stop the behavior that was occurring. And so I think we have both a problem of people and structure. I think the issue of the structure came to light to us, especially when a new commander came on the scene, Chris Omont from Hennepin County Sheriff's Office. And given the structure that was in place, new commander Omont was unable to move forward with the reforms that were needed. And I think it was an extremely difficult and stressful time for him. So clearly something was wrong, and something needs to be done, because as you know, in law, you mandate that the Metro Gang Strike Force exists. It has been at least temporarily suspended from operation by the action of the Commissioner of Public Safety. So during this legislative session, something needs to occur in terms of the law and what we're going to do moving forward. The Office of the Legislative Auditor did not make specific recommendations about what new structure could occur. Frankly, some of the events about suspending the Metro Gang Strike Force occurred after we issued our report. So we didn't necessarily anticipate that we would end up with that gang strike force suspended and the law needing to be changed. So I think Representative Paymar and you have been addressing this issue and expressing your concern. And so I think we're at a point of consideration of possibilities for moving forward. And thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, and Representative Paymar.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee members for Mr. Nobles? Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nobles, I don't know if you've had an opportunity to review the DE-4 amendment or if you've been working with Chair Paymar, but I guess is this directionally correct from your perspective based on the – is this – I don't want to say directionally correct. I don't want to put you in that position, but is it consistent with – with the results of your audit and some of the recommendations that were made?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Coles and members, I think what it is trying to do is recognize that there is benefit and value in having a multi-jurisdictional police operation to address gang and drug problems. And so it's trying to hold on to that as a benefit, but set up the kind of structure that would ensure that multi-jurisdictional organization has adequate accountability and oversight. That really was one of the problems that we saw, that you had a collection of officers coming from many different jurisdictions to gain the strength and benefit of that, but not with the proper accountability and oversight. And so exactly who were they accountable to? And what we saw is that chain of command had broken down. And I think that what this is trying to do, and obviously I leave it to you to ultimately make that judgment as to whether or not it achieves that, but it is trying to put in place a stronger structure that will ensure accountability and oversight.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Nobles?
And again, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Nobles, one more question for you. I know you have to leave, but how is it, in your opinion, that the chain of command in a violent crime coordinating council will not break down in the way the previous oversight was established? What's different about it?
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, I did receive the strike all amendment and I have looked at it briefly. But what I see is one provision, and possibly Representative Paymar can point it out, but what I read is that any multi-jurisdictional police operation that again receives funding through the state is going to have to be under the supervision of one of the participating police agencies. And so that, again, was one of the issues. Exactly who are these officers accountable to? There may actually be some discussion and controversy about that. I know individual police officers typically like to have any sort of disciplinary action or concern about their behavior reported back to their home police organization. And so it really lessens the command, or at least it did in the Metro Gang Strike Force, of the commander of that police operation. And Chris Omont expressed to us very strongly that he felt like he simply did not have the control that he needed to effectively manage the Metro Gang Strike Force. So I think that Representative Paymar's provision tries to move in the direction of making it clear who is in charge, who is in command, who will be responsible and accountable for this multi-jurisdictional operation.
And Mr. Chair, if I can add to that, is one of the things in, that we've tried to do throughout the bill, if you read it, is that we really maybe have given the Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety more authority than he may want in terms of oversight, but we're really asking that when a situation, if it ever occurred again, like happened last year when we're not in session and this thing clearly imploded, the commissioner really had no option except to cut off their funding, which was the proper thing to do. However, the advisory board and the strike force, for that matter, continued to exist. So what we want to ensure is if anything like this happens again, that the commissioner could close the operation down. And that's another level of oversight.
Thank you, Representative Paymark. Now, is this Representative Hillstrom, is this a question for Mr. Nobles because he has to leave, or is it a question for Representative Paymark?
It's for Representative Paymark.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony
thank
for
you,
the committee, Mr. Nobles.
Chairman, members. Thank you.
Appreciate Representative
it.
Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This might be more appropriate another stage, or might even be to the commissioner, but in the event that the commissioner goes in and shuts down a group, what civil law responsibility attaches to the state? And maybe the commissioner would be the better person to take care of that. Because I want to make sure that in the event that there was no wrongdoing on the part of the state, that the responsible parties are the ones that have the financial obligation to...
Ms. Perius can probably answer that because one thing that this bill does do, it actually does shut down the Metro Gang Strike Force Advisory Board. But it makes it very clear in section 2 of the bill that the language that was drafted that the any liabilities will be met by the current joint powers entity, which is the in this particular case would be the League of Cities that is handling the outstanding cases that regarding seizure and inappropriate seizure and forfeiture. Is that, am I saying that, Ms. Perius?
Ms. Perius.
Correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, yes, I think the reference you're looking for is on page 3, lines 22 to 24, and basically is trying to, as Representative Paymar said, maintain the status quo. If there's responsibility on the part of the municipalities, that any action taken by the commissioner will not result in those liabilities transferring to the state.
Chair, if you'd like, I can briefly walk through the bill, or I could tell you what the amendment does, whatever.
Why don't you walk us through, because of the recent nature of the DE4 amendment, okay. Representative Paymar.
Chair Lesch and Chair Hillstrom, I'm assuming that this will be going to, I didn't really make a motion here, did I? What is the proper motion?
The motion, well, we incorporated the changes to have the DE4 before us, so why don't we go ahead and do that, Representative Paymar, since you wanted to get going before. Representative Paymar moves that the DE4 amendment, as amended, we can do that, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight.
Okay, and then, Mr. Chair, because there's some financial issues in here, this will then have to go to finance and then to public safety finance. So it has a few stops. So if there are some problems with the bill, and you will see in my brief presentation that there are some concerns, that we will work on this as it moves up. So I just wanted to make that clear. So what the what section 1 does in the bill, we in our meetings with DPS, they wanted us to change the name of the gang and strike, what is the gang oversight council, to be the violent crime coordinating council, and we're changing some of that definition because I think DPS is correct that you do have other activity that gangs are involved in that's violent in nature
specifically that comes to mind here in Minneapolis, and less so in St. Paul, but in St. Paul and especially on Indian reservations where gangs are very active in trafficking and recruiting and beating up young children to be involved in gangs and prostitution. So that's just one example. So we wanted the Gang Strike Force to have that sort of mission to combat gang activity on a broader level. We've changed the membership. The Department of Public Safety felt that the size of the Oversight Council was too large, which was 32 members. We've narrowed that down to 15 members. I understand that there may be some concerns about the membership, but we're flexible around looking at this issue. But this is the current, this is the proposed membership, which
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, do you want to let Representative Kamar walk through the entire bill and then take questions? Or do you want to take questions section by section? I'm fine either way.
I think based on the nature of the changes, it'd be good that we just take questions as we go. Representative Kamar, are you okay with that?
That's fine.
Go ahead, Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions about the membership, Representative Kamar. Number one, I believe that the U.S. Attorney had presence on the previous. I just don't know that we can compel the U.S. Attorney to participate in this, and I would hate for the council to not exist because they decided for whatever reason that they couldn't or wouldn't participate. And so I just flag that issue I don't know that we can compel them to participate, and if they're not, let's make sure this thing doesn't blow up because the federal government decides not to participate. And we can think about that as it moves forward. I don't think there's a need for any discussion around that. And then Chair Paymar, again, I'm not prepared to offer any kind of amendment. I haven't had a chance to really think about this, but I note that we have two citizen members going on this panel, and they're to be put on by the commissioner in consultation with representatives from the Council of Color, and I'm just not sure if there's a lot of white gang activity and non-minority gang activity, and I don't want to suggest at all that the councils on color wouldn't be representative of those issues as well. But I do raise the issue. I'm not sure if that's the best policy or not. I want to think about that and whether we should specifically include in the bill reference to the councils of color. And I don't have a problem with anybody consulting with them, but I want to make sure that the citizen members who are considered are considered as broadly as possible, and not I don't want to run the risk of being overly narrow in who we're looking at or who we're considering for that. And I guess it's more a comment than a question. And I hope that you'll work with me at least on the first one and making sure this thing doesn't disappear if the feds decide not to participate.
Absolutely. And Mr. Chair, because the goal is that the language says that the commissioner shall consult with representatives. It doesn't say that. So how, I mean, we could sort of maybe tinker with that language if it had some. But I would add that at least in the metropolitan area, it's neighborhoods of color that, where there's been significant gang activity and where at least the problems with the Metro Gang Strike Force most existed. So to not have some involvement by those communities that were most impacted by gang activity, to me, would be a mistake. And if we can figure out some better language, I'm open to that. So, Mr. Chair, then next is the subdivision 3 of that section then speaks more to the authority of the coordinating council's duities. Number 4 and number 5 were recommendations from the Department of Public Safety. Some of this is existing language. We did want something maybe the commissioner wants or doesn't want. I'm not completely sure. We've had several meetings with him and his staff, but we want the Commissioner of Public Safety to approve the operating procedures and policies manuals that to investigate gang and drug and crime activity. On Section 8, we are asking the Commissioner to look at the criteria and identifying characteristics used in determining whether individuals are or may be members of gang involved in criminal activity, and reviewing sort of this policy to ensure that that we aren't profiling individuals in our neighborhoods that in our communities. The subdivision 4 deals with all of the various responsibilities of the commissioner, and here's sort of the crux of the bill, if you will, that that the commissioner must establish guidelines for the certification of multi-jurisdictional entities. We added at DPS's suggestion that and their designated fiscal agents. As you know, that was one of the problems that was brought out in both the Lugar and Noble's report about the failure of the fiscal agents to see the problems that were going on and correct them. And to keep in mind also that there still are task forces out there that may not get state funding or money coming through OJP. This only applies to those task forces that get money that's either federal money that goes to OJP or state money that's appropriated. We also have information here, and this came out of both the reports, the Nobles and the Lugar report, that we really want to ensure, and we can work with the department on this, but we want to make sure that there are operating and financial audits that occur periodically not only on the finances of the task forces, but how they're conducting their law enforcement activities. What else can I say? The other element, as I said earlier, it gives the commissioner the ability to dissolve the entity or their governing boards and transfer those duties to the department if deemed necessary. Presently, there is no authority. And the language on the statewide coordinator on Subdivision 5 is the same as current law. Most of the other language is some of it is current law. We also suggest in the bill that participating officers shall be subject to annual performance reviews conducted by the entity's governing board. We also, another change here is that it is permissive. The commissioner, and this again would come through the OJP, consider appropriating grants under this section to fund community-based intervention and prevention efforts for youth. And what we're trying to get at here, that if we're really serious about trying to stop young people from getting involved in gang activities, there are programs out there, and there should be programs out there that work to try to intervene and get those kids from moving down that path. The governing board and the role of the prosecutor, this all came out of the Lugar report and their recommendations. The role of the current of the Attorney General is all current law, and then the final section is the one I spoke of earlier, which dissolves the advisory board. And then the final section is an appropriation, and this we still have to think through because I think if we either we appropriate some money or in the grants that go to the joint go to the multi-jurisdictional task forces, they would have to use some of their grant money to conduct the audit. So we have to think that through a little bit if we really want an outside independent audit that's going to cost some money. And so that will be up to, I think, the Finance Committee when it comes to us to see if that's the direction you want to go, or if we trust that there could be, that the present internal audits that are conducted by the statewide commander are sufficient. But clearly there was a problem last year or in years past where, where these report cards that evaluated the gang and strike task forces were being used, and I think we need more audits than that. It just did not seem sufficient. Otherwise, I think that this problem would have been stopped earlier. So that's the bill, members. Can I just say one quick thing here? And one thing that I am a little, this bill looked different, as you probably saw, those who looked at it the day before yesterday. And I'm not, I did not take this language out of the bill lightly, but I think that there are some significant issues related to databases and the collection of data, and how people end up in some of these data systems. Some of you, I don't think anyone here was around maybe on the legislature when we set up the pointer system. And that was a statewide process that could identify gang members by certain criteria who could then end up in this statewide database that has oversight by the BCA. The concerns that I, and there's people here I know that want to testify to this, has been, you know, is it okay to allow law enforcement to independently set up a database without any standards or criteria except what that independent law enforcement agency decided was the criteria? Is there any oversight by the governing board, for instance, the county or the city where that police department or that sheriff's department is, to have oversight? And I was trying to get at some way that the state should have, that the Violent Crime Coordinating Council would construct a system and some criteria to make sure that there was proper standards. Now, since I offered that, and since that was part of my bill, law enforcement has brought some concerns about it. And I think we can work this out with them. We have had meetings with Superintendent O'Malley, and I know that people from the and law enforcement, I just spoke with them earlier, are willing to work with me and the NAACP to come up with some criteria that made sense and that they could live with. So we're going to be working, and hope so we'll either try to amend the bill as it moves up the ladder, or we'll introduce a separate bill that deals with this. I know Chair Mullery also has some issues that he's would like to see addressed. The final thing that's not in the bill is the issues around seizure and forfeiture, which was a very big issue, as you will recall, where property and money was seized improperly, housed improperly, and used improperly by some members of the Metro Gang Strike Force. There are several bills that deal with seizure and forfeiture. It's complicated, and we decided to keep that provision out of the bill, and that those bills are traveling separately. So with that, I would stand for questions, and I know there's some people who want to speak to the bill.
Thank you, Representative Paymar. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Paymar. You probably won't be able to answer this question right now, because I just finished constitutional law and taking the bar, and I'm not certain I can answer this question right now. But anytime you appropriate money and then have the commissioner approving what the guidelines or the rules are going to be, and then the potential that money is going to be given back from the group to the state, you need to make sure that then you don't make the board a de facto state actor under the Constitution. So I suggest that you work with staff to make certain that, based on that little test I learned in constitutional law, you didn't just make the board a state actor. So
that might be something good you learned in law, Mr. Chair. Are you talking about the dissolving the advisory board and what?
I'm talking about as we go forward, mm-hmm. making certain that when we put together a board, and the state gives money, and then the state approves what the policies and procedures are, and then the state has the ability to get money back and benefit from the action, because during the audits, right, they may have to pay for the own audits, therefore the state might be getting something back, money. You need to make sure that under the Constitution you don't make that group a state actor. So it's constitutional law, it's under the federal law, not under the state law, so you just might want to talk with some of the lawyers around here to make sure that doesn't happen.
Ms. Pierce, do you understand the issue that she's raising? And I don't know if you want to speak to it now, or is it an issue we need to address?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom. Previously, I pointed out the language on 3.22, but I believe Representative Hillstrom might be talking about the coordinating council's duties and having the commissioner approve certain policies and procedures. And the bill doesn't extend that limited liability to that section, so we could look at putting that in there. I don't know if the commissioner would have an opinion on how this has worked in the past, if they've done that. But
Commissioner, do you have an opinion? Let the record show that he does not have an opinion. Representative Hillstrom, was that on the bar exam, that question?
Yes, actually, Mr. Chair, it was.
Thank you. Okay, we'll deal with that as we move forward. Any other questions for members of the Representative Coles?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope we haven't created a monster with Representative Hillstrom. Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, this has absolutely zero to do with the substance of the bill, but I'm curious, and we're in the Crime Victims and Records Committee, and we're all trying to figure out how we're going to save every nickel we possibly can or spend fewer nickels. As the Republican lead on your committee, Mr. Chair, I receive a lot of really nice bound reports from all the different agencies that we have jurisdiction over, and they're required to do all kinds of reports, many of which contain really good and useful information. And I don't want to suggest that that the reporting requirement you have in the bill is not appropriate. But I'm just wondering if we, as this committee or the public safety committees generally within the legislature, maybe I can convince some more of our colleagues in other committees that these reporting requirements, that we move into the 21st century and we require that the department transmit them to us electronically, make them available on their website, and stop printing so many copies of these reports. And while I don't want to suggest in any way that that will get us anywhere near solving our $1.2 billion challenge, we should stop spending nickels wherever we can stop spending nickels. And let's put the onus on whoever is going to be reading the report instead of on the agency to spend the money printing and binding and making things look real pretty. PDFs work really, really well. So, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to offer an amendment now. I may have one as we move forward. And I think that as a legislature, we should start thinking about how we can maybe move into the 21st century and save the agencies a few nickels here and there.
Representative Paymar?
I believe that we passed a law just to that effect last year, Representative Coles.
That was a great law. I hope I supported it.
I'm sure you did. So, and a few reports.
I'm still getting a lot of reports, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, the few reports that I get from DPS are usually a few pages. I mean, there are some, that the one that on the fire safety, on the fire training centers ended up costing $58,000 to compile all that data and send us a nice bound copy, which since the legislature didn't follow any of their recommendations, I'm not sure that we need those in the future. But I'm all with you if we can make this simple and inexpensive.
Thank you, Mr. Paymar. I believe the only reporter in here left the room, so we can talk about cutting those reports out now if we wanted to. any other questions by members of the committee for Representative Paymar about his bill? Seeing none, then Representative Paymar moves.
Mr. Chairman, I do think that there's people who want to address this bill.
Oh, that's
bill,
and right. Thank you, Representative Paymar, for reminding me. Members of the audience, if you wish to be heard on the bill as amended, keeping in mind the items that Representative Paymar had clearly stated were taken out, that includes the items about the pointer system and the seizures and forfeitures provisions have been removed. If you still want to be heard on the substance of the DE4 amendment as it's written, come down, please state your name for the record and be heard. And please make sure that you sign in on the sign-in sheet, too. Okay, the page has the sign-in sheet over there. Go ahead, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Franklin, Minnesota Sheriff's Association Executive Director. I just want to make a couple of very quick comments. Number one, this has been an extremely difficult situation for law enforcement, for all of us. Number two is it's important to remember, and Representative Paymar, we thank you for your work on this and working with us. has alluded to the fact that this is one of only 26 task forces, and so this is what we refer to as an anomaly. Secondly, I think some very important things have come out of all of this, and if there's anything, how do you make something good out of something bad? I think one of the most important things that we saw in the Sheriff's Association was a report that was done by St. Thomas and Ms. Levy concerning their concerns. And we've opened the dialogue and had them at our Sheriff's Conference, and I'm pleased to say that I think that was a very educational thing. We want to move forward with and working collectively together, because what we found is many parts of that report we actually agree with. We're in the same, our goal is really the same. We have just a few things in here that we would like to address, and we'll work with the author as they go through. One of the things that we've seen that we think is a failure is the size of the council was so large it almost became somewhat ineffective. We also think that the current makeup, we have Minneapolis, St. Paul, Hennepin, and Ramsey County, the four biggest agencies in the state, and in essence they would only have one seat or two seats on this. We think that they all need to be there because the volume of criminal activity is within that core jurisdiction as we go around the state. And we think we can tweak the membership on this a little bit and make it better and make it fit and have meaningful and valuable input. So there's a minor things here. I won't even touch on them that are just wordsmithing. But I think that we're very interested in collaboration and working together, and I think we can actually come out of this with a much better product, much better bill, and a much better way to serve our citizens of the state working collaboratively together. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Franklin. Next testifier.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Gaviglio. I'm the litigation management attorney over at the League of Minnesota Cities Insurance Trust, which, as most of you folks are aware, is the liability insurer for over 800 plus Minnesota cities, plus a number of joint powers entities, which includes the Metro Gang Strike Force. So we are currently defending the litigation that involves the Metro Gang Strike Force, and we're also administering the property claims hotline that we set up to facilitate people getting back their property that was improperly seized from them. In my role of overseeing all the litigation as well as this hotline claims process, I've worked closely with the legal counsel for the Metro Gang Strike Force, who is Corey Land, and unfortunately she couldn't be here today, so I'm kind of here in her stead. The only concern that we're raising with this proposed bill is the Section 2 provision, which talks about the dissolution of the Metro Gang Strike Force Advisory Board. As many of you may be aware, this Gang Strike Force was made up of over 12 plus constituent members of cities, counties, and the Met Council. They currently only meet, the advisory board meets at a maximum once a month, sometimes every other month, and their sole purpose now is to wrap up the unfinished business and take care of the obligations, the legal obligations and other obligations as set forth under the Joint Power Statute, which is 47159, to wrap up the business. As Representative Kamar indicated, they are not performing any law enforcement function. There are no officers assigned. They're not doing anything with law enforcement. All their goal is now is simply to wrap up the business of the Metro Gang Strike Force and take care of their obligations. There's two primary concerns that I see, or we see, as to the provision that dissolves the advisory board. Number one is whether there's in fact legal authority to do so. The question is whether the legislative body has the legal authority to dissolve a joint powers entity that was lawfully created pursuant to state statute 47159. If you look at that statute, it has a specific provision for termination of the joint powers entity, and that's contained in subdivision 4, and it says such agreement may be continued for a definite term or until rescinded or terminated in accordance with the terms. This is a separate legal entity made up by the constituent members. It's for all practical purposes an executive body. Where we see a problem here is, frankly, it raises a very serious issue of a separation of powers concern. You've got a legislative body unilaterally dictating the dissolution of an executive body, a joint powers entity. You know, I didn't know I was going to be coming here until yesterday afternoon, so I haven't had an opportunity to research this issue, but if you have not researched this issue, I strongly urge you to get a legal opinion from the Attorney General's office or your appropriate legal counsel as to the legal authority for that. The second concern raised is the logistical and practical problems with dissolving this advisory board. As you are aware, the Metro Gang Strike Force still currently has property in its possession, has cash funds in its possession. If you dissolve this board, who is going to make the decisions on how this property and cash is dispersed? And again, I would refer you to the Joint Power Statute 47159, which specifically provides within the statute for how disbursement of funds should be handled when the joint powers entity is rescinded, as well as distribution of property. They've got active claims, they've got lawsuits to deal with. That's what the advisory board is dealing with. They've got legal counsel that's advising them, and they're also working with their insurer, the League of Minnesota Cities Insurance Trust. Ms. Land has indicated that they still have approximately 20 vehicles in their possession that were deemed to be properly forfeited, and those vehicles will have to be sold by public auction. So the advisory board needs to deal with the sale of those vehicles and also has to deal with the disbursement of the proceeds for the sale of those vehicles. They also have approximately $1 million in cash that needs to be properly dispersed. That's what the advisory board's role is. Again, as I indicated, the advisory board is only meeting to wrap up the issues involving the Metro Gang Strike Force. They've got able legal counsel providing them with good legal advice. This process that they're going through is very transparent. When they meet, they're subject to the open meeting law. I know for a fact that every meeting that they have, there's members of the media that attend. So they're subject to the open meeting law. They're also subject to the Data Practices Act. So it's a very transparent process. Ms. Land is constantly responding to data requests from the media, wondering what's going on with the process of wrapping up the business. The goal that the Metro Gang Strike Force Advisory Board has is to hopefully wrap up all of their current business and obligations by the end of the year. Those of you who are attorneys understand how slow, fortunately, the litigation process is, and we currently have about 6 or 7 active litigation cases that we're trying to either get resolved or have decided, but we're at the whim of increase of the court on that. The practical reality is we still have, you know, there's decisions that have to be made, and eliminating this advisory board puts it in limbo. There's the proposed legislation doesn't have any dictate on who's going to make those decisions other than says that each of the individual members assume the liabilities and responsibilities. So for example, if you have a determination on a claim, presumably under this statute, each and every governing body of all the constituent members, that means every county board, every city council, the Met Council, would have to decide individually whether they approve or disapprove. And what will we do if 7 of them say yes, we approve, and 5 of them say no? All it would do is create more logjam in trying to wrap up the business of the Metro Gang Strike Force. So those are the concerns. Again, what we're trying to do is wrap up that business and work with everybody involved to make sure that the folks that have legitimate claims get their property back, get compensated, and the folks that don't have legitimate claims, we're not paying public dollars for those. I appreciate your opportunity to appear before you, and I'd be willing to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Gaviglio. Are there questions of members of the committee for Mr. Gaviglio? Representative Coles.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just...
Representative Paymar.
Just so This just didn't come out of thin air, the language here, and Ms. Perius has put a tremendous amount of work into it, and I just would like her to respond to the issues that were raised.
Ms. Perius.
Mr. Chair and Representative Haymar, I'll address the legal issues that the testifier raised. I have not found any case law that would address the exact issue here of dissolving a joint powers entity, but I was able to find case law which supports the legislature's ability to pass laws that impact local governments in joint powers agreements specifically. And in those cases, the court held that if the legislature has provided the authority to create something, that would imply the authority to withdraw that ability. And in the situation at hand, the legislature has created the statutory authority for the local units of government, the joint powers authority, and the Gaines strike forces. And this would imply, or it could be argued, this implies the ability to withdraw that authority.
So thank you, Ms. Perius. It's always good to have common sense buttressed by case law. Representative Haymar, did you want to further address this?
I'm willing to continue this discussion. I know this is controversial with the league, and as I said, the bill's got some traveling here to go. But my issue here has always been, just quite frankly, is I know we need to resolve these outstanding claims. I know that has to happen, and the process is a good one. I appreciate that. It bothers me that the very entity, the Metro Gang Strike Force Advisory Board, continues to exist when, in my estimation, they were responsible for oversight over the Metro Gang Strike Force and failed in their duties, failed miserably. And that is my sole objective here in trying to not only cut off funding for them, but also to dissolve the very entity that should have known better and should have intervened.
Thank you, Representative Paymar. And I know there are further questions, but while we're on the topic briefly, I wanted to ask, and maybe Ms. Perius can answer this question, why, when we are repealing 299A641 in the repealer section 4, do we procedurally necessary have to have express language in section 2 above that dissolving the gang strike force? If we are repealing the enabling language in law that allows them to exist, why do we have to have an additional section saying, well, by the way, also they're dissolved? Is there a procedural legal reason that I don't know about that we need to do that?
Mr. Chair, Section 4 is repealing the current authority for organizations to form, and since it's already formed, I believe it would still need to be dissolved under Section 2.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions? Representative Olin, did you have a question?
I'll save it to later. Maybe we can work it out, but I do have some concerns because I can think of at least three joint powers up north that aren't necessarily doing exactly everything some of the state legislators would want. Now, under this president, they probably could dissolve all three of those, too.
Thank you. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure that I have real big concerns about the first part of this. I tend to believe that which we create, we can take away as well. But I haven't done the legal analysis on that. But I do think, Chair Paymar, I guess I'm glad to hear you say that we've got to work on the second issue, because the second issue is obviously a big issue. If we've got 20 vehicles that need to be sold, and then the proceeds from that appropriately distributed or paid out, if we've got $1 million in cash that needs to get returned or appropriately dealt with, we just got to make sure there's a process in place. And if we can transfer all of this to the department, I'm sure they'd be thrilled to take it on. There's got to be a way to do this. I appreciate your frustration with the continued existence of the oversight board at all, but I don't know a better way to make sure that the claims get handled. So I, as long as you're willing to keep working on it, I think we share the same goal. Let's get this thing wrapped up as efficiently and quickly as possible, and make sure that we move forward in a more transparent, more accountable way. But I think that the testifier raises some really good points, especially on the second piece.
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, I want to belabor it. I think Ms. Pirius would back me up in saying that nothing in this bill would preclude the League of Cities from resolving its outstanding liabilities.
Thank you. And Mr. Caviglio.
Ms. Pirius.
Oh, Ms. Pirius, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative Paymar, I'd just point out that under Section 2, the joint powers entity and the advisory board are being dissolved, but the rest of the agreement wouldn't be affected, I don't believe.
Thank you. Mr. Caviglio, when are you going to get this done? When are these cars going to be liquidated and the cash taken care of in a trust or what have you? When's the work going to be completed?
Well, Mr. Chair, actually, Ms. Land has taken a very proactive role and went out and worked with the advisory board and got an inventory of all the vehicles. The vehicles that needed to be returned have already either been returned to the rightful owners or the lien holders, whoever that may be. The remaining vehicles are vehicles that have been deemed to be properly forfeited, and those will be sold through the auction process in the normal timely fashion. So I would presume you're talking about a couple months for those.
So all the work, just so I'm clear, all the work that needs to be done is going to be done in a couple months?
As to the specific question of the vehicles, we still have this hotline claims process open that thus far we've had approximately 30 individuals file claims, and we've investigated those claims. Some of those have been resolved. Some of them have been denied, and then there's an appeal process for these individuals to go to the Office of Administrative Hearings on that appeal.
Okay, well, let me just be clear then. Not just the cars, but all assets over which the current entity has control.
Okay.
When is that going to be done? And to avoid the response, well, when we get done with the process, I know that. When's the window going to close by decision of the board to finish up?
Mr. Chair, as to the valued assets, I would say within 6 months to the end of the year.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me what role the board needs to play in the hotline claims? Isn't the league taking care of that? And so why wouldn't the claim issues be dealt with by the league and the board issues, such as the cards and the cash, be dealt with by the board? I mean, what role does the board play in that?
Mr. Caviglio.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, the way that the hotline's claim process currently works is we are administering it on behalf of the strike force, and if we deem that it is a valid claim, we pay the claim, but then it's subject to reimbursement from the advisory board. And so then the advisory board has to meet to approve that disbursement of funds.
Any other questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, then Representative Paymar renews his
Mr. Chair, I do think this.
Oh, yeah, do we have other testifiers out there? Oh, appears there's. Oh, you ready? You were going to testify?
Yeah, briefly.
Sure, come on down and testify. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning. I'm Nakima Levy Pounds. I'm a law professor from the University of St. Thomas School of Law and the director of the Community Justice Project. And with me is.
Good morning. My name is Hugo Chan, and I'm a second year law student at the University of St. Thomas School of Law, working with Professor Levy Pounds.
Thank you.
Please proceed, Professor.
Thank you. As Mr. Franklin alluded to, our office conducted research on the gang databases that are currently being used in Minnesota. We looked specifically at two. And the reason that we're focusing on this issue is because it is a very important issue.
I'm sorry, Professor Pound.
Yes.
Not to interrupt you, but we did remove, as I understand, we moved all those relevant provisions out of this amendment. Is that correct, Representative Paymar, with the amendment?
Mr. Chair, we did, but I have to say it was not it was not something that I wanted to do, and I think it would be helpful to hear, because the language could come back in the bill, and if I just think as a courtesy, I would hope that the committee would hear the comments by Professor Levy.
Well, thank you, Representative Paymer, and I would love to do that, actually. My only concern is we still have your bill and Representative Hillstrom's bill, and we have 19 minutes left here. So what I would propose, Professor, is if you can address this as best as you can, very briefly, and I'm sure, because it may come back in, this will need to be addressed again in Chair Hillstrom's committee, and so on, as this bill moves along. So with that in mind, please address this, which, of course, was a very relevant issue, what people were talking about prior to the time it was taken out.
Definitely. This goes to the issue of accountability and transparency, and this is something that is very important, again, specifically to communities that have been disenfranchised. Over the course of several months, we conducted a series of town hall meetings. I believe, Mr. Chair, that you were present at the first hearing where there were various representatives from law enforcement, local government, the judiciary, talking about the collection of gang data. And after that initial town hall forum, which happened in July of 2009, we all left with more questions than answers. And so we really see quite a few parallels between the information that came out in Andy Luger's report and the information that we glean from looking at the statutes and looking at other data connected to collection of gang data in Minnesota. And so this is an issue that impacts communities of color. I heard it asked about, whether or not it's necessary to for the commissioner to consult with representatives from communities of color. Well, just to give you an example, African Americans represent about 5% of the population in Minnesota, but they represent 54% of those who are listed in the gang pornophile and 42% of those who are in GangNet. So yes, there are white gangs, but they are underrepresented in these gang databases. And we believe that part of the reason for that underrepresentation is the way in which the 10-point criteria has been structured and developed. We're also recommending that a number of reforms be made to the collection of gang data in Minnesota, specifically looking at auditing practices and ensuring that audits are occurring regularly, primarily because of the potential for collateral consequences of people whose data is mistakenly entered into gang databases. Additionally, we're looking at the need for purging requirements. As some of you may have seen in the media, GangNet, which was started in about 1998 with funds that originated from the Department of Public Safety, had nearly 17,000 names of suspected gang members. Without regular auditing and purging and accountability, oversight, or transparency. So we heard from people in the community about the impacts that this has had on their lives and may potentially have. So we will be working with Representative Paymar and hopefully members of law enforcement to try to get some language related to oversight and accountability of these gang databases to make sure that only those who are in gang databases are the ones who belong there, and that people within communities of color are not being placed in gang databases because of the color of their skin or because they meet 10-point criteria that is overly broad and subjective. So quickly, Hugo Chan is going to talk about another pertinent issue that came up within the community related to parental notification and how parents of children under age 18 would like to be notified if their child is in a gang database so that they can take appropriate steps to intervene.
Thank you, Professor Levi Pound. And before you proceed, Mr. Chan, Representative Olin has a question for Professor Levi Pound.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have a question, but I have a suggestion. I realize you do have a valid issue, and I'm not even attacking this issue. I'm just commenting. I think this bill in its present form is something we should work with on this particular issue. I think we need another bill to address what you're saying, that so it can be handled in more depth, because I think it's getting well beyond where this issue was originally going if we get into the rest of his testimony. I have nothing against the idea, but I think it should be done by a different bill than trying to put it all into this.
Thank you, Representative Olin. And you know, I think, as was discussed, this has been taken out, but because this was a major topic area when the original scandal, if you will, arose, it's going to be a topic of conversation surrounding this bill, regardless of whether that actual language is in. So, and also, they came all the way down here to testify. So, Mr. Chan, please proceed to your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Currently, there is no law in the Minnesota statutes regarding parental notification when a youth is included in any gang databases. And in accordance to what Representative Paymar actually has noted before, prevention is very important in terms of having that prevention is very important because that it is the first step to getting everything done that prevent youth to involve in crimes and actually the gang activities. And then so we look at our sister state, Texas, actually has a notification system when a youth under 18 years of age is included in any gang database. Texas law provides a provision that local law enforcement agency would be able to notify their parents, so parents would be able to take steps to prevent and help rehabilitate the youth into a productive member of society. And then also Texas took it a little bit further that a member of the public can actually require the Texas law enforcement agencies to notify them whether they're actually involved in any gang databases and whether they have any confidential data on them. And then they would have an in-camera and judicial review like processes so that makes sure that everyone on the database should be there instead of being targeted of their race and color and gender. And it is very important provision for prevention of future crimes, and we think that it is very important for all of us to think about this issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chan. Are there questions of the committee? Representative Coles.
Just one question for Mr. Chan. The Texas statute that you referred to with the parental notification, is it a mandatory notification or is it permissive on the part of law enforcement?
Mr. Chan.
Mr. Chan, Representative, it is not mandatory. However, I would like the committee members to look at the judicial actual legislative intent of the senator who raised the bill. It especially stated that this provision will empower or it will have a tool for law enforcement agencies to notify parents. So although the statute may say may, but actually it's in our view it is an empowering statute that would give law enforcement agencies have the power to notify parents. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just a very quick comment. I would not be supportive of a mandatory notification. I can envision all kinds of scenarios where law enforcement, for very legitimate reasons, may not want to notify somebody, at least in the near term, that somebody's in a database if there's an ongoing investigation or whatever the case may be. But providing a tool to law enforcement so that we can get parental involvement early on and maybe get somebody on the right course early on, that makes a lot of sense to me. But as long as we're talking a permissive notification as opposed to mandatory, I think we're probably able to find some agreement around that.
Other questions of the committee for the testifiers? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony, and be prepared to come down here again, I suppose.
Thank you.
Are there any other members of the committee that wish to be heard on this bill as amended, keeping in mind that we have not a lot of time? I don't see anyone else coming down. That being the case, then Representative Paymar renews his motion that House File 2965 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Paymar, and thank you to the testifiers. Representative Paymar, are you prepared to proceed on House File 3089?
I am. And we don't have a lot of time, so I could walk through it real quickly.
If you could, but by way of motion, Representative Paymont moves that House File 3089 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee. Please proceed, Representative Paymont.
Mr. Chair, members, I don't have to tell this committee of the annual horrific occurrences of domestic assault murders in the state of Minnesota. Every year, 25, 30, upwards as high as 50 women and children are killed at the hands of a domestic abuse offender. We are learning more about what the criminal justice system can do relative to intervening in domestic violence cases. This bill attempts to address some of our current laws that give the courts more ability to track those domestic violence offenders that are that are most at risk of committing a homicide. And I might point out that Minnesota, at least last year, had the highest number of homicide suicides that were domestic assault related. And we think that these four provisions, where are my testifiers? We think that these four provisions will help the court. The first one deals with no contact orders. And there's been some confusion about criminal no contact orders in the past. And so this provision attempts to clarify the criminal nature of the domestic abuse no contact order that is currently in the family civil court statute. The second provision in the bill is deals with bail, and members, this would allow the judge to determine if there's a significant risk to the victim or the public that the judge could set any bail in any amount necessary to gain the protection of that victim. So essentially it would remove the cap on misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor bail when setting risk. And interestingly, this all came about partially by a bill that was chief authored by Representative Lesh, which is called the Blueprint for Safety, and I'm hoping we're going to get a chance to hear about this, which is a St. Paul initiative, although funded by the state, that looked at, are there ways that we can intervene and assess whether someone is poses a risk to a victim? And Chief Justice Magnuson agreed to having the bench used, which was what is called a bench card now, that lists all of the different risk factors that a potential batterer may pose to a victim. And so we're hoping that with the use of this risk assessment at this level, that if the judge believed that this particular offender posed a significant risk, that they could have impose a much higher bail on the individual. The third element of the bill deals with deals with witness tampering. And this strikes a word out of the current statute that requires coercion to charge and prosecute someone, I think witness tampering in the second degree. People who are involved in preventing and intervening in domestic violence cases know quite well how a domestic violence offender can intimidate and threaten a victim to not show up in court. This is for, and Representative Lesh and others who prosecuted, Representative Olin probably heard this a million times, is you'd get your case together and you'd be all ready to go and the victim wouldn't show up. Why doesn't she show up? Usually it's because she's afraid. She's been intimidated, she's been threatened, in various ways she decides to capitulate, does not show up in court, which is extremely frustrating. And it's also unsafe to that victim. So this would provide another tool to a prosecutor to prosecute on witness tampering. Did I cover everything? Do we have anything else? Maybe if we could, Mr. Chair, we have someone from the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women to fill in whatever I failed to explain.
Absolutely. And if there are questions, members, please hold them. Noting we have 4 minutes left, and please introduce yourself and state your testimony for the record.
Yeah, Shalene Johnson from the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. A couple things on the, if you have any questions, I can answer those. Essentially what we're looking at is, in the Terry Lee bill, adding the photos to go attaching to the criminal no contact orders. It's currently on the civil order for protections. The courts have asked us to do that and also be inclusive of the juveniles. Representative Paymar talked about the witness tampering. The other significant thing too is removing the criminal no contact orders, the DANCOs, from 518B into the criminal code. There's been a lot of confusion around this. jurisdictionally, people are interpreting this differently. We're really looking to make this clear and an order that's separate, that stands alone from any conditions of release. That's a highlight of what I have for you.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson and Representative Paymar. Are there questions of members of the committee for Ms. Johnson or Representative Paymar? Seeing none, being straightforward, then Representative Paymar renews his motion that House File 3089 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. And we still have about 3 minutes, so why don't we take up your bill? Is 3 minutes enough time for you, Representative Hillstrom? We'll go a little bit over here now, too. In the interest of efficiency.
Members, I would move that House File 3090 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee. Mr. Chair,
Representative Hillstrom.
Current law has both a harassment statute and a stalking statute, and under the stalking statute, the definition references the word harass. And so this bill is to clean up that confusion in the statute as well. This bill also amends that what crimes may be considered when establishing a pattern of stalking to include murder in the first through third degree, manslaughter in the first and second degree, assault in the first and third degree, domestic assault by strangulation, inferences with an emergency or interference with an emergency call or a violation of a domestic abuse nor contact order. Mr. Diebel has found some grammatical errors, and so he has an oral amendment that he would like to do to clean up the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Why don't you please state your oral amendment for the record?
Mr. Chair and members, the technical amendment is found on page 1, line 15. The restore the stricken language and delete the new language.
Okay, so that would be the number 3 and the strike the number 5, Mr. Diebel, is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Is that the only one?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, then Representative Hillstrom makes that motion to get the bill in order. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. So to the bill as amended, Representative Hillstrom.
That's it, Mr. Chair, unless you have questions.
Okay, you don't have any testifiers, Representative Hillstrom?
Well, the same folks that were here with Representative Paymar are happy to talk to you as long as you have, but if the committee has questions, I'd like to give them the 2 minutes if they need it.
Okay, are there questions that committee members have? Okay, then why don't we go ahead and proceed with them,
okay.
Representative Hillstrom.
Shalene Johnson from the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. Thank you for your support on this. We've been working on this issue with a statewide group, the County Attorneys Association and law enforcement entities statewide. We did a training recently this past year of over 500 officers on stalking, and what we found out is there was a lot of confusion, and this is really an effort to enhance and clarify this, to clean it up, to help law enforcement officers in the state to be able to arrest on this, and then for prosecutors in order to be able to take these cases and charge them. We do have general support from the County Attorneys Association, the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. We are continuing to work with them on language clarification, but we do have their support on this. That's it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Another question, questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, then Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 3090 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes.
And thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Before we adjourn, members, I'm going to take the prerogative of the chair and state, just because Representative Paymar brought it up, regarding the blueprint for safety. I was in the city attorney's office I guess it was Wednesday. People may remember in the time when we passed the blueprint for safety that I came forward and other members from St. Paul and Hennepin, Ramsey County came forward and said, we're going to have a pilot project here that's going to address public safety concerns for domestic violence in St. Paul. And we'd like money for that. We'd like you to pay for our unique audit through Praxis International to talk about how we're addressing domestic violence uniquely in St. Paul.
from the state. We'd like the state to pay for it. And a lot of questions obviously came up saying, why is St. Paul Ramsey County getting money for this? We need this throughout the state. We said, no, don't worry about it. We'll make a really good program, and then you can duplicate it in other parts of the state. And there was some suspicion, rightfully so. I came back from the city attorney's office on Wednesday, and I was just amazed at what they were able to come up with and the results that they've gotten in unique and innovative ways of addressing how we interact with domestic violence victims and the crime itself here in Minnesota that is already being duplicated in many of your jurisdictions throughout the state. I pushed it because obviously I want to get money for my area. I did believe that we would duplicate it and it would work as promised, but even I was flabbergasted to see the results that we've gotten from that. So I just wanted to use this opportunity to tell you all that's what you're getting for your money, and I look forward to seeing it being implemented in your jurisdictions. With that, members' committee is adjourned.